So we should always think, I believe, as general counsel, that law is only the starting point.
My name is Sarah Carnegie, and I am the Legal Projects Director at the International Bar Association. Together with my team, the Legal Policy and Research Unit, we've created a series of podcasts on business and sustainability to look at the rapidly increasing need for companies to act responsibly and sustainably, considering not only their legal obligations, but also in consideration of what is referred to as soft law, which is now hardening at pace. In this episode, IBA business and human rights lawyer Maria Pia Sacco and I had a discussion with Nick Folland and Sarah Dixon, General Counsel and Deputy General Counsel for international retailer Marks & Spencer, about their work in this regard. We then went on to speak with business and human rights practitioners Jonathan Drimmer from Paul Hastings in the US, Ray Lindsay from Clifford Chance in the UK, and Hanim Hanza from Zico Law based in Singapore. Our discussion focuses on the retail side and challenges in ensuring that products are appropriately and sustainably sourced throughout their journey in the supply chain. So it's lovely to see you both, Nick and Sarah, today. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm going to start off by talking about the UN guiding principles in the context of the last decade. And we know that they've introduced a sort of framework of action, which has been supplemented, of course, by various legislation that has been introduced in different countries. So we have an entire legal framework regarding business and human rights, which is made up of a combination of hard and soft law. And Nick, I just wonder how you as general counsel are navigating that framework and how you're advising your board.
Really, you started in exactly the right place, which is that mix of hard and soft law. You mentioned, you know, we've got a large number of stores, over 1,000 stores. We're in nearly, well, we think north of 100 countries. We operate off more than 100 websites. We have 23 franchise partners. We have 70,000 colleagues and, you know, 32 million customers. So I think it's fair to say it's a relatively complex area, relatively complex business. By the time you add on top of that all of the logistics, the construction that we have for stores, contract cleaning, et cetera, you'll see that there's an awful lot of scope for there to be some risk in what we do. So we run a system of what we call managed risk assessment, managed risk acceptance, if you like, because we are going to take some risk. We have to accept some of it's there. And you know, to demonstrate that, we used to have people in the car cleaning business operating out of our car parks. We withdrew from that in 2018 because we couldn't satisfy ourselves as to the human rights scenario surrounding that kind of activity. Hopefully what I've painted there is a picture of a situation where you're going to have people who are always trying to find ways around your systems. You can take all of the contractual comfort and assurance that you like, but people will try and cut corners. If I illustrate that, you know, if you ask someone for a permit, actually the question you should be asking is, well, the permit they provided, what's its provenance? Where's it come from? Can I rely on it? So we should always think, I believe, as general counsel, that law is only the starting point. What you then have to do is supplement the legal basis. The way we do that is we have global sourcing principles, code of conduct, confidential reporting procedures, that sort of thing. So you're introducing on top of your legal basis, the hard law, some soft law, which is an element of check and challenge. Take our audit program. Sarah's going to talk to you about that in a minute. But you don't tell people when you're going to turn up, because whilst you might have a contractual right to do an audit on a set day, you're sure as eggs are eggs, if you turn up on that set day at a set time, you'll see things very, very prepared for you. So we give people a window. We tell them there'll be a window when we'll appear, because of course you can't just spring a visit on them. And then, you know, in that window, at some point we will pitch up. So hard and soft, a legal ability to go in and do that kind of audit, but then some soft around, well, when you're going to do it, and just being a bit smart about when you do it. So that's answering your question about how's the mix between the hard and the soft law. As to your question on governance, we set up a board committee in December last year. We established an ESG committee. And the reason for that is that you've got to have the ability to spend a bit of time on this subject. It doesn't really lend itself to the kind of quick conversation, reporting in, here you are, here's the dashboard, we've done this type of conversation that you might have in a full board meeting. it's nuanced, it's difficult. You need to collaborate with other people. You need to learn from others. You also need to be introducing new technologies, as you'll hear about later in the conversation that we've been doing. So it's an area where you need to have the freedom to have some debate and some conversation. So the way we advise the board is through a subcommittee that is full of experts and people who have particular knowledge in this area, and where you can kick ideas around a little bit more than the rather more formal reporting that you get in the main board. So hopefully that answers the question.
No, that sounds very impressive. And obviously governance is really key in all of this. And I'm interested to know, in terms of how you operate in the agri and also apparel sectors, are there any differences in the way in which you tackle modern slavery risks?
Well, going back to that word you just used, the governance, broadly, it's the same. All our new direct suppliers, whether to the food business or clothing and home, as we call it, they have to go through a robust onboarding process and required to complete self-assessment questionnaires, and ethical audits have to be done. And they're done by third parties, incidentally. But the main difference comes in the geographical location. About 80% plus of our food factories are based in the UK, whereas we don't currently manufacture any clothing in the UK. So if we take our clothing business, that's the challenge there is, well, how are you going to deal with the fact that your factories are overseas? And instantly there are about 900 of them in 40 odd countries with about 740,000 people working in them. So it's a significant footprint we have. And there, what happens is, once the supplier is onboarded, they are required to do an annual social compliance assessment that has to take place within a specified window of time. I was mentioning that earlier. And then we have a regional compliance team. We have 7 global sourcing offices. And what they do is they take the output of those assessments, and again, they're done by third parties. And then our team, our sourcing office teams, work with the factories. And if there are any issues identified, they put a corrective action plan in place. In contrast, in food, we've got about 500 factories, and there are about 215,000 workers in them, primarily based in the UK. And what we do, the difference between the two sides of the house are that in food, we risk assess, and then we design an audit program around those assessments. So for example, all of our protein processing sites on all of our produce and horticultural pack houses are automatically classified as high risk. So they're given more frequent visits. And then this is the key to how it works. We have our commercial buying and technical teams in those factories very, very regularly. And so it's them that are going to see any human rights problems or modern slavery risks if they exist. So we have to train our buyers and our technical teams. We have to put them through training. I mean, they're highly, highly qualified professionals in their own right. But then what we have to do on top of that is guide them as to some of the warning signs that you need to look at for modern slavery or you know, human rights abuses. So again, it's not about hard law and policies only. It's about people on the ground. And then all the other thing we do is we're always sharing with our buyers and those that are actually placing orders and the like, the consequences of their actions. So, you know, the idea that one might need to suddenly change an order, it has a consequence in a factory, and we want people to be aware of that. The other thing that we do actually in common across the two businesses is we do collaborate. I know I've been describing our complexity and our size. You know, we're more than 10 billion of revenue, but actually that's tiny in if you think in the global supply chains. So we find it's best to join forces with others. So we spend time on something called the Consumer Goods Forum. We're very connected with the BCI organization. That's Better Cotton Initiative. And then we ourselves were one of the founding partners of the Modern Slavery Intelligence Network in the UK. And that we formed following the conclusion of a police operation, Operation Fort. And that's about sharing knowledge across our industry partners, done in the right way, of course, but to make sure that as a collective, we are keeping our eyes open and learning from others.
I'm interested, if I can, just quickly to understand actual examples then of where modern slavery has perhaps been uncovered, if you can give any of those, either in the UK as part of Operation Fort, which you've mentioned, or as any of your overseas operations may have kind of led to.
Yeah, Operation Fort, what we found there, or actually the police found, was that there was some immigrant labour in the agricultural sector in the UK, and the people involved, you know, had not been put through the right channels. They were not being supported properly. They were not being their human rights were not being respected. Basically, what we had to do was we had to instantly, that the news broke that there was going to be a prosecution, we had to make sure that none of these people were involved in our supply chain. And it actually turned out that it was some seasonal workers in a supplier to a supplier. And so it was extremely peripheral to our supply chain. That said, what we were then sure to do, as I say, was to create this network, because, you know, there are smart people involved in these things. They're trying to get round the law. So just because there's a contractual requirement for us that they're going to do certain things isn't actually going to solve the problem. What you need is people on the ground. And it turns out that the reason that this had been spotted was because, you know, a third party who was paying visits to the relevant farm had just seen some warning signs and some indication that there's some inappropriate behavior was going on. So what we thought was, okay, let's create that network so that we can share where those warning signs are seen. Our rule will be that there is no human rights abuse in our supply chain. So the minute any of it appears to emerge, we act very, very swiftly.
We have been talking about also social auditing, but in your modern slavery statement, you also refer to the challenges of mainstream ethical audits. Sarah, I would like to know from you, what are these challenges and how are you addressing them?
Without a doubt, audit remains a key tool for us as a business, and will continue to form that baseline when we're working with our suppliers, you know, without a doubt. But clearly last year, with lockdowns and temporary factory closures due to COVID, we still managed to do some in-person auditing. But I suppose the exciting, innovative approach that we were able to accelerate last year was our use of virtual assessments, which effectively meant that auditors were able to virtually go to factories, take virtual tours of those factories, interview management separately, interview workers within those factories, which has obviously been great and obviously accelerated because of COVID. I mean, your question, Maria, rightly talks about the challenge of audit. And the key point is that audits capture a moment in time, whether they're in person or virtual, and they're unlikely to identify modern slavery at a site. You know, as Nick said earlier, there are some clever people out there trying to find ways around the system, and they're doing that all the time, and we're trying to always get ahead of that. I mean, our plan, therefore, is always to combine mainstream audits, which, as I say, give a baseline, with other activity. So, for example, nothing is ever going to be hearing from workers directly. And a key part of our strategy going forward is going to be to scale our worker voice programme. Because, you know, as Nick said a few times now, in this space, it's not really about hard law and rules. It's just about being really smart, as smart as we can be. Following a pilot in food, we expanded our worker voice programme last year. This allowed us to hear directly from workers about their experiences working in the factories, and is absolutely vital. I mean, we use that technology to engage 54 different sites, which allowed us to connect with almost 3,000 workers in the UK and Ireland. We've trained now over 130 suppliers. And the exciting news is that we'll be rolling out the programme to over 500 of our sites by April 2022, which is great news. In clothing and home, in January 2021, we launched a similar pilot in 9 factories within India. And that pilot has already reached over 4,000 workers. And the great thing about it, I think the best thing about it, is it's the accessibility. It's translated into a number of different languages, and it's just so easy to use. It's on an app. It's just incredibly easy to use. So I suppose to conclude on the question, you know, we're really proud to have long-standing relationships with our suppliers, and we work closely with them on programmes, picking up those risks that audits just would never pick up. We're involved in lots of collaborations, such as the Stronger Together partnership. We've also supported in the development of the Responsible Recruitment Toolkit, which enables our suppliers to access resources on responsible recruitment. I mean, it sounds very boring, but a good and a robust legal framework which supports continuous improvement activity is absolutely key. We are continually developing our policies with input from in-house experts, suppliers and external stakeholders. We've got group-wide policies in place relevant to modern slavery, you know, all of which are signed off at director level. And just to add, culture is incredibly important, I think, in this area. So I suppose I can't emphasise enough the importance of those human rights policies being 100% supported by our leadership. In addition, our suppliers are also required to sign our global sourcing principles, which set out our minimum supplier ethical and environmental standards. The principles are drawn from the international standards and collaborative codes like the Ethical Trading Initiative base code. So those standards that we use set out our suppliers' responsibility to achieving and maintaining and enforcing those standards within those parts of the supply chain involved in producing or supplying M&S products. I think an ongoing theme within our business is that we will never stand still in this area. And so to demonstrate that, this year our food business undertook a review of our ethical standard. And in January of this year, they launched a new human rights standard, a really practical standard, which has a really key focus on effective human rights due diligence within supply partners' own operations and supply chain. And that standard will become effective, has just become effective actually from April of this year. We also in 2020 identified the need to enhance the effectiveness of our controls within our goods not for resale category, where we'd focused on that less than our goods for resale areas. So we've partnered with a third party provider in that area to assess our supply base, covering things like ethics and human rights. And this will provide us with some brilliant auditable data on those risks, and it will allow us to identify a baseline once again and work with those suppliers who don't yet meet our minimum standards.
The concept about how business operates in this space has recently been looked at by the ABA, American Bar Association, and their business law section has been working on what they classify as a model contract clauses for the supply chain, which essentially it operationalizes human rights due diligence in supply chain contracts. So that's making it clear that the abuses of workers' rights, which may occur across the global supply chain, is actually a joint responsibility, a shared responsibility between buyers and suppliers. So essentially, that's kind of broadening out the concept of responsibility. Do you foresee any challenges in that approach?
Yeah, I think credit to the ABA for leading on this. I think it's a good initiative. I think to the question is whether there are any challenges, it goes rather back to what we were saying to each other earlier. You need a legal framework, no question. That's a great thing, and it's really good to see some model contracts coming out. But that's only where it starts, because the framework won't alone be enough to stop abuse of human rights. What you then got to do is supplement it with the kind of thing we've been talking about, worker voice programs. You know, take one of those as an illustration. You put in a contract, you must have a worker voice program. Okay, so the contract's met. But then the question is, and incidentally, you probably go on in the contract to say that must be run by a third party, so you're guaranteed some independence in the voice you're hearing. But then the question is, what are you going to do with the data? And that's where I think you have to mix this sort of hard legal framework with the reality of operating in you know, complex supply chains. You need, as an organization, as the buyer of the product, to then say, okay, here's our approach. Here's what we're going to do with the data. We're going to take it seriously. We're going to require that our suppliers then improve on the output and, you know, are acting on it. So for example, in Sarah mentioned earlier, our global sourcing principles, you know, we require that people then have grievance mechanisms in place for their workers. We insist that they have active worker representation groups and that kind of thing, because it's all about, yes, have a legal framework, have a legal underpin, but then actually deploy that, take some further steps. The point being, I think here really is that you have to collaborate with your suppliers. You know, damages, indemnification, breach of contract, termination rights, that's fine that you've got them, but actually that's not what it's about. Because if you go into a factory where there's been an allegation and you say, here's my contract, I'm going to terminate the supply arrangement, well, you're only going to amplify the problem. It's far better that you have a team on the ground that understand the issues, that work with the relevant factory and eliminate the problem without suddenly cutting off supply, finding a load of people have lost their jobs, and the practices that you're trying to prevent just go, you know, below the radar.
Thank you, Nick. I guess this is about building trust. Sarah, how do you make it happen?
You build trust through collaboration and not consequence. So if a supplier knows that they've done something wrong, that we're immediately going to terminate them and we're not going to work with them, then in those cases, we won't be told things. And what I've learned kind of while I've kind of been getting closer to some of the experts in this area is that what we're wanting to do is to get the suppliers to talk to us. So in order to do that, you've got to have a relationship where they tell you, they flag issues, and then you work with that supplier, as opposed to say, well, you have a problem, so we're going to terminate you. So it's about collaboration and not consequence.
Finally, then, in relation to how sustainability has been integrated into your business model, one assumes that that's to a large extent driven by consumer behavior and investor behavior. Is there anything specific you'd want to mention in relation to that? Because it is a changing dynamic out there, isn't it? You know, we're seeing market forces driving behaviors, not just through law then, but through generally what's expected. And that's happening across a range of ESG activity. You know, it's the kind of buzzword for now, isn't it? Climate, people, profit being, you know, the issues that are being focused on.
And you're right to point out, you know, consumers, customers and investors are, you know, key influences. But the first thing to say is, and forgive me, I'm now showing my age, you know, when sustainability first came into business, it was all about having a team, a sort of central team. You know, there was a belief, well, we'll give sustainability to them. And as this has matured as a subject over, well, you know, 20 years, I suppose, people have come to realize that having a bunch of people sitting in center being sort of the finger waggers doesn't work. You know, you don't want people inside your organization just telling everyone to do things. It's not how it operates. So we've gone through a transition in sustainability of setting up teams, big teams centrally and delegating all the work to them, to actually now understanding leading organizations in the sustainability field integrate this activity into their business model. So at Marks & Spencer's, it is simply how we do business. Then the only other thing to mention is investors. Well, it's great that the investor community are now requiring that this is a dominant agenda for leadership teams. And I mentioned earlier, we've recently set up our ESG committee, Environment, Social, Governance. And that says to the whole organization and to anyone engaging with us, this is a subject that is important to the board. And that shows that we're really serious about it. The question is, what's the role of the retailer? Is our role to choice edit? Or is our role expanding now to also drive behavior change?
Our conversation then turned to law firm partners, experts in business and human rights, to hear about their role in supporting companies in the sustainability agenda. We've spoken about the business and human rights legal ecosystem being made up of soft and hard law principles. So I'm wondering, Hanim, if I can turn to you first, how are lawyers navigating this fragmented legal framework when advising companies?
I would say closely monitoring legislative developments, helping clients carry out human rights impact assessments, taking proportionate countermeasures, reviewing and reinforcing some complaint mechanisms and speak up programs, reviewing the extent to which clients are equipped to address supply chain risks, including training and seeking independent expert advice. Reviewing role and resources of in-house legal and compliant functions as they play a key part in addressing these new challenges.
We often find that clients approach us to seek to address particular situations in which they'd like to understand what their responsibilities are under the UN guiding principles, and how to implement that respect, how to address those issues consistent with the guiding principles, and to understand the extent to which that response might differ from what they're legally obliged to do. and also in terms of how they are addressing those issues, how they do so using legal tools, which is where lawyers can help them, and whether in doing so they're actually changing the nature of any legal risks they may be engaging in that process. I think that navigating the framework is becoming more challenging simply because the frameworks are evolving very quickly, both the practice around implementation of the guiding principles, but also in terms of evolving legislation that is seeking to implement those concepts into legal measures, and also through practice in the legal area, through contracts and business relationships and so on. So it's becoming much more difficult for lawyers, I think, to keep up with all the changes. And it's also always been a multidisciplinary area, but becoming much more specialised, I think, within particular sectors or particular areas of law.
The European Commission is expected to present a proposal for an EU-wide legal framework on mandatory human rights and environmental due diligence. Ray, what will the implications of this law be for the UK?
Well, we obviously have to wait and see exactly what the terms of the new legislation are and the extent to which they are intended to apply to companies operating in the EU market but not incorporated there. But on the assumption that they do apply to UK incorporated businesses that are providing goods or services or otherwise operating into the EU, then that will be a significant change for UK companies who are not currently under any such requirements. The UK Modern Slavery Act, as we all know, has been widely criticised for only imposing a transparency and reporting requirement under Section 54 that requires companies to disclose the steps they are or are not taking to seek to ensure that there's no modern slavery in their business or supply chains. And although that's intended to drive a due diligence aimed at the eradication of modern slavery, it's not an express requirement. And current legislative proposals to tighten up the Modern Slavery Act don't currently indicate that that will be a new requirement. So that would be an additional requirement on UK business. To the extent that the EU wants to try and standard set more broadly than the EU market and encourage due diligence, I think many businesses, once they're subject to such a requirement, even on a relatively narrow basis, do tend to gravitate towards the highest common denominator. So I think in practice, we can see that those kinds of moves will encourage more businesses to apply human rights and environmental due diligence more broadly across their businesses, even probably beyond what is legally required of them.
And what about the US, John?
I mean, I think the EU directive, to the extent that it's adopted on terms fairly similar to those being discussed, is going to have a very significant impact on U.S. multinational companies. And I don't think U.S. multinational companies are paying nearly enough attention to the breadth of those impacts. The draft, as it's currently contemplated, covers three substantive areas: human rights, environment, and governance. It looks not just at supply chains, but the entirety of value chains. So that's upstream and downstream, which is different from what you see in a lot of modern slavery laws. It has a risk assessment, a due diligence component, an institution of management systems, mitigating measures component, evaluating the effectiveness of those measures, and reporting elements. So there are four key requirements. And when you look at the breadth of this, upstream and downstream and business relationships across three substantive areas, four key activities as part of the core requirement, it's going to have a huge impact on U.S. businesses that are operating in Europe, again, assuming the legislation comes to pass, and it'll be much broader than what a lot of them are doing under their modern slavery requirements. So I think it is going to have a big impact on U.S. businesses, and folks really aren't paying that much attention to it yet.
On January the 6th, 2021, this year, Marks & Spencer's became one of the first companies to formally sign the call to action on human rights abuses with a brand commitment to exit the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, where Uyghur population and other Turkic and Muslim majority peoples are subjected to arbitrary mass detention and forced labour. What is the role of multi-stakeholder initiatives in addressing modern slavery?
So I think multi-stakeholder initiatives, particularly when we're talking about Xinjiang, do have an important role to play for a couple of reasons. One, businesses are really trying to figure out how it is to approach Xinjiang, which is one of the most difficult business and human rights situations I've certainly seen in my time doing this work. Number two, they are able to act instead of businesses. There has been retribution against companies by the Chinese government when they do make statements that are perceived as too aggressive or improper. And so multi-stakeholder initiatives obviously can make those statements instead of the businesses themselves. And then finally, multi-stakeholder initiatives really are quite effective in terms of setting standards of behavior and standards of care within sectors that they apply to. And that does allow for a level setting among businesses who are trying to confront this. So I do think multi-stakeholder initiatives have an important role to play, particularly when we're talking about the issues in Xinjiang.
Consumers and investors are increasingly concerned with sustainability and ESG-related issues. How are lawyers and law firms responding to this demand?
So one of the challenges, I think, for both consumers and investors alike is to gain reliable information on what is a sustainable product or a company that is operating responsibly, both with respect to things like climate change and human rights. We increasingly see ratings and measurements that attempt to gauge that, but I think it's really difficult often to for these to be comparable. And it is useful for lawyers to try and help clients to understand what might be more objective and reliable indices than others. We also see increasingly that in order to be labelled, for example, environmentally sustainable under the EU taxonomy, a business will have to show that it's aligned with UN guiding principles. And I think there's a real role for lawyers to do to help clients to develop their diligence processes to be able to assess whether an investment is really aligned with UNGP or not. So those are all areas in which there are challenges, I think, for consumers and investors. And obviously, all of these new legislative measures that encourage greater transparency and disclosure in some ways are going to assist that, but there has to be some rationalization about it and how to compare and gain meaningful information to allow consumers and investors to make informed decisions.
Yeah, I think you can separate this into what companies say and what companies do. And lawyers have an important role to play in both. And so in terms of what companies say, there's an increasing focus and demand in terms of non-financial disclosures around sustainability issues, whether it's consistent with SASB or GRI or other types of reporting mechanisms. And lawyers can very much assist companies in reviewing and preparing disclosures consistent with financial disclosures that are fulsome, accurate, and designed ultimately to meet the demands of investors and consumers. But whatever you say you're doing, you actually have to be doing. And lawyers as well can assist companies in making sure that their processes, their programs, their systems, their activities are aligned with what they're saying publicly and with larger sustainability initiatives. So I do think there are important roles to play with both. And as we think specifically about consumers, no question that consumer demand connected to investor demand is having an enormous impact, particularly on brand-facing companies, but even on companies that are more B2B. What you do see from consumers is expectations, for instance, around forced labor, around Xinjiang, understanding exactly how it is they're approaching those kinds of issues in terms of sourcing, in terms of their processes. So I think for lawyers, there's a lot of opportunity to assist companies with both the investor and the consumer side around processes and disclosures.
I think this neatly moves us into the concept of stakeholderism. And we know that there's been a lot of debate on this, and certainly it's something that John Ruggie has recently written about. And there's a move towards companies needing to deliver value, not just to their shareholders, but to employees, customers, suppliers, and communities. I'm interested to understand what the legal constraints may be that preclude companies from approaching stakeholder interests of an independent end, or whether there's any other sort of issues on the legal side in this regard that you may wish to comment upon.
Well, obviously the exact parameters of this are going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, depending on what the relevant company's legislation says and what directors' fiduciary duties are defined as being. I think there's a difference between what directors can take into account and then their leeway of discretion as to what the overall objectives are of their decision making. There is a palpable shift now from sort of short-termism towards a longer-term sustainable approach to business and the social purpose of business. And that is that's reflected certainly in the UK, in the nature of directors' duties and on the considerations that should be taken into account as to what's in the best interests of a company, for example. And certainly with the EU's Sustainable Corporate Governance Initiative, should that go through, there will be a really palpable shift towards stakeholderism, as you have described it. That will certainly mean that, you know, a broader range of interests can legitimately be taken into account. There's obviously a difference between, you know, general corporate law and then obviously, I think in the States, for example, quite restrictive requirements on what can and can't be taken into account, for example, in relation to investments, which creates a bit of a divide between the US and Europe. But that's something slightly different. I think in overall, you know, what's a company about? What's its purpose? What is considered to be in the best interest of a company in the longer term? As I say, we're seeing a shift.
Yeah, I think we are seeing a shift. And, you know, in particular, we're seeing an increasing use of salient risk analyses as part of enterprise risk matrices alongside materiality analyses. So looking at a potential impact on stakeholders associated with business activities that are distinct, potentially related to, but distinct from financial impacts. I think we are seeing much greater corporate activism consistent with the Business Roundtable statement. Companies obviously are evaluating where they want to be on issues of the day, and particularly in the United States around things like the Georgia voting law. We saw a lot of corporate activity on that took different perspectives. That's certainly a reflection, number one, of what consumers and external stakeholders are expecting and demanding. It's a reflection, number two, of what boards and senior management ultimately want to do, how they want to position themselves, how they feel individually. But it's also an important recognition of employees as key stakeholders. And that's one area where we've seen a particular rise over the last several years. Employee voice, particularly as you see enhanced communications between employees outside of the workplace on social media. And so I do think we are going to continue to see more and more corporate activity in the U.S., certainly around sustainable business measures. And quite frankly, I think the law and regulations are going to go along with it. And the final point I'll make is, you know, we are increasingly seeing cases brought in the United States under Caremark theories, duties of good faith for directors that do have a sustainability ESG components to it. And in the last few years, those cases have had a little bit more resonance in the courts. And whether that's because of the nature of the underlying facts themselves, or courts are also starting to see the connection between ESG and materiality, I think that still remains to be seen, but it's certainly something that we're watching closely.
What are the challenges and opportunities for the legal profession and the IBA, of course, over the next decade?
I think the key challenges and opportunities really fall into two buckets. So the first one is what we are seeing is human rights becoming a distinct and concrete area of legal practice, much as anti-corruption, much as money laundering, much as terrorist financing, much as export controls are their own distinct areas of legal practice. And it's going to be important for legal practitioners to come up to speed on what really is involved when we talk about human rights norms and human rights legal requirements, because they are different. They are different conceptually, since we think about this as risk to stakeholders, as risks to business. They are different in terms of the substantive requirements that go into it. And I do think it is going to take a good bit of time for the profession to come up and gain the fluency and expertise that is going to be required to master this new discipline. But the second is I do think this is a field that changes incredibly quickly, not just because of stakeholder demands, but also because of what's going on externally in terms of developments like artificial intelligence, like technology, like those kinds of activities that really do require application of these emerging principles and norms into new areas really before those principles and norms have been fully defined. And so I do think as we look forward, an incredible opportunity for the legal profession to master and apply this new discipline, real challenges as we do think about how these things get applied to emerging disciplines like artificial intelligence and other technologies.
We currently see supply chain contracts requiring suppliers to meet prescribed human rights standards. a breach of which could entitle the buyer to the full range of contract remedies, including damages, et cetera, whether or not the buyer's own decisions or actions contributed to the breach. What do you envisage being the challenges and opportunities of this approach?
So I think the AVA's model contract clause project reflects an important dynamic, and maybe it's two dynamics. So the first, as we've talked about, is the role that lawyers and the legal profession can play in instituting human rights norms into business relationships. And the second has to do with the increasing recognition that human rights is a business imperative, much as we saw with anti-corruption 15 years ago. Back then, FCPA clauses weren't quite common, and today you see them in virtually every contract, or anti-corruption clauses, maybe not FCPA specifically. So by effectively requiring that suppliers enter into contracts that do have human rights clauses, what we're basically saying is human rights, like anti-corruption, is going to be part of this relationship. And if you want suppliers to take things seriously, putting it into a contract as opposed to just asking them to acknowledge a supplier code of conduct is a further step that really does help integrate human rights in the way that we do see moving more generally. And having it again in contracts is it emphasizes the important role that lawyers can play here. There were just a couple of us in the old days, and to sort of see the growth of this field is really quite remarkable. You know, I feel like we've waited a long time for this, but it's incredibly energizing and rewarding to see how fast things are moving and how much it's really taken of late.
Sustainability and ethical business practices are things that most people really care about. Customers and investors are prioritizing these issues, and businesses have woken up to this, even if doing the right thing costs more in the short term. Legal advisors have long played a key role in managing social, ethical, and environmental issues for organizations, but as we have now heard, they are no longer simply reacting. They are now proactively shaping and integrating ESG risks into their organizations' policies and strategies. By ensuring sustainability is embedded into corporate governance and broader business operations, in-house lawyers can help shape the culture and corporate decision-making of companies. Developing robust policies and procedures which actually work on the ground will increase investment and stakeholder confidence and help companies attract and retain talent and customers.